Brigadier Calvert, real two.
One must remember that in 1947 the Americans had called back all their troops from all over the world and had reduced them to about a tenth of what they were, and that Britain alone was carrying out the defences of the world. And we had about a million troops, that's Army, Navy and Air Force, still under command, I mean still caught up. And that we were looking after places, the whole of North Africa, Abyssinia, Eritrea and things like that. We had missions in Austria, in Germany. We had missions all over Indonesia. There's quite a lot of fighting going on in Indonesia. In Indochina, we were fighting there. Places like Madagascar, we hadn't handed back yet. The whole of India, the whole of the Middle East, including Iran and Iraq and Syria and everything else. We had enormous responsibilities right round the world, which we hadn't divested ourselves of, and there was no forces by Japan or Germany or Italy or any else of that nature, and we were the kingpins, but we had no money to do this with. We had to rely still on the Americans. The Americans had stopped Lend-Lease hadn't started then. Lend-Lease, yes, or during the war. They'd stopped Lend-Lease within a day, in 24 hours, without giving us any notice whatsoever. And so I'm mentioning how it had its effect on the troops on the ground, and there was Montgomery, who became Chief of General Staff at that time. He had enormous responsibilities all over the world. And so it was most enlightening to see how he dealt with it. Now, one of the purposes of this CIGS's exercise is he got back all the generals from outstations all over the world, you know, like Hong Kong and Libya and Singapore, Vietnam, Indonesia, and so on, all over the world. They all came along. They all had their problems. They all thought that theirs was the only problem in the world. They thought that all the difficulties were something unique. And then there they met other people who had the same problems, and they could discuss it with them. And it made themselves feel that they weren't alone, and they had opportunities to talk to quartermaster generals and adjutant generals, and to the military secretary, and to the Montgomery himself, and it was a great gathering, and you could meet, and I met a lot of these people in the war, knew them. It was great meeting them all. But I had a reaction, and I can say that I was drinking more than I should do, so an awful lot of other people. My mess bill wasn't the biggest, but there are a lot of people who were drinking. It was a natural reaction after the war, I think, after people had been on active service a very long time. They're making excuses for it. But in this way, one kindly thing which Montgomery said, and I've never seen it in any biographies about him, and this is not in any way, I'm saying it a kindly thing, was that he took me aside once and he said, you know, we all think of him as a strict teetotaler. Well, he said that after his wife died early on before the war, I think even he was in Palestine, he said he started to drink and drank too much. And he found himself drinking much too much, and it affected his judgment. And he managed to stop. And He said he never had a drink after that. He said he doesn't mind other people drinking, or this, that and the other, but he himself found he couldn't take it. And he told me this, and he said, I think you're drinking a bit too much, you must try and stop it. It's a very, very kindly thing to do for a field marshal to tell. I was a lieutenant colonel, but I'd purposely taken off my pips to become a major because I was substantive rank. One time, one sees the stories, he had me up at the high table, which all of which were full generals, and myself, Major Calvert, you see. And he used to use me as a sort of thing to take rises out of the others. He said, now, Major Calvert, why is it that here I have all my generals, here's a general, quartermaster general, adjutant general, military secretary, etc. I ask them questions, and what do they say? They say, well, I'll have to look into this, I'll have to have a meeting about this, or I'll give you back my views in a fortnight's time, or something like that. But you, Major Calvert, when I ask you something, you say it should be done like this or like that. Now, why is it that you have these views and my generals don't have? So I said, well, I'm the only one, I think, who's in his substantive rank. You can't reduce me that a court-martial. And he roared with laughter, and then he brought this up at one of the meetings, you know, when all the staff officers were present. He made me stand up and said, I want more of you officers to be like Major Calvert, which earned me a lot of dislike to a certain extent, but also a lot of leg pulling. But he was, you know, he felt he sort of made me as a member of his staff and was showing confidence in me, I think. When that finished, I didn't know quite what was happening to me after the staff college, and I was sent to Trieste on the governmental side. There was the military governor, and then there was Colonel Parsons, and then myself. And we had, of course, it was combined with the French, and we had to deal with all the external problems. We had people from the Foreign Office and the State Department to advise us, but we were the executives. And my main job was staff studies and on all the situations which were arising, and preparation of papers and reports to the United Nations. And this was very hard work, and I also had to deal with all the troubles on the frontiers when they were shooting between ourselves and the Yugoslavs and so on like that. And I used to work very hard, and I was supported by Colonel Parsons, who was a brilliant officer, and he taught me how to write and staff studies and planning papers. And I would do them. Sometimes they'd take me 3 weeks, and I'd have my bed in my office, and I'd concentrate my mind on that and on nothing else. And then at the end of a fortnight, 3 weeks, I'd ask for leave, and I'd go away, possibly to Venice. I'd say I want to buy a Venetian blind and for a week, and then I'd come back again. And this is a way that I worked at. And it was very, very interesting. We met all the top Italians, and I was put on a boundary, I was head of a boundary commission between Yugoslavia and Italy, and we had all sorts of people on it, Italians and Yugoslavs, Americans, Russians, Austrians, and I think that's about all.
How did you find the Italians and Yugoslavs to work with?
Well, the Italians were of two sorts. There was the northern Italian and the mountain Italian, who were very fine people, very aggressive and so on like that. And they were naturally terribly interested in this. The Yugoslavs were... there was no aristocracy amongst them. They were sort of serfs. I think I dealt with a chap, I can't remember his name now, but he had an invented name, you know, a lot like Stalin or Sorokoput or something. And he was a good soldier, very good soldier, but he was slightly out of his depth. And he had to take... he had to take orders from above. Now, what I did, and this again is, I don't take much credit for it, I said, we had this meeting, and I said, now, gentlemen, I think that we should come to one thing. If we can't come to an agreement on anything, I suggest we go over to the nearest trattoria and have a drink. And that we must stand drinks strictly in rotation, so that, and very often over the drink, we may come to a solution. And they all agreed. They thought this is an excellent idea. It's doing the boundary, remember, after we've been looking at the boundary. And so then I was asked to state how the Boundary Commission was getting on. This is from the United Nations. And I reported that we had, I'm going to forget the name, I may have to ask you this, we better switch off. I was asked this question, how we were getting on, and I said that we had all agreed on the procedural methods required to come to an agreement on the various parts of the boundary, and which was true. But evidently it was the first time the Western powers and the Eastern powers had agreed on anything, or pretty nearly. And suddenly we got congratulations coming in from not only from the United Nations, but from the different governments. They made rather a lot of this. And so when I announced these congratulations, everybody laughed their heads off, and they knew what the methods we'd used were. We'd all stand and drink to each other. And so then we had a secret between ourselves, and this brought the members of the Frontier Party close to each other, and so that if we couldn't come to a problem, the Yugoslav or the Italian would say, well, my boss says I must say this, that and the other. Then the Italian might say, well, my government says this, that and the other, and I'm left in a very difficult position. What answer shall I give? And so we could come in with them and suggest answers to them, and one way or another we got this friendly atmosphere in this thing, and we finished demarcating the boundary. I had some sappers coming along behind us, so as soon as we agreed on a thing, we put in a concrete pillar with a bit of with an iron bar in it, and this was the provisional boundary. And so, as we went along, we actually marked the boundary all the way. And this is the boundary between Italy and Yugoslavia over that area. So, this is how it's done.
Did you find that political prejudice entered much into the work, with Italy being capitalist and Yugoslavia being communist?
They had already got a number of agreements which were absolutely necessary. For instance, in there were hydroelectric stations in Yugoslavia, and which the boundary had now cut across, and Trieste hydroelectric power came from Yugoslavia. So the Yugoslavs and Italians had already come to an agreement on the payment of this. Then there was the question of fuel, and the another power station. See, the hydroelectric power only came at certain times of the year when there were floods. And then the power station went back to fuel. Now, the fuel, part of the fuel was raised by, I remember Mussolini reclaiming land and growing things in it. Well, it was mostly cane, and cane was burnt in this power station when it had grown up in the year. And other times it was fed by Yugoslav timber. And so these agreements had already been made for the mutual benefit of either side. And then there was shipping. I had to write a paper on the 3-mile limit, 12-mile limit, and so on like that. Because Trieste could be, if we stuck to a 12-mile limit, Trieste could be cut off. And if you remember, Berlin was cut off about that time, I think. And they could have applied the same thing, Yugoslavia could have applied the same thing to Trieste, if they'd... And so I had to look into this all and write a paper. Now, I had advice, as I tell you, from a very good Foreign Office chap called Sullivan, who'd been a consul general, I think, in Switzerland during the war, a lot of dealings with both sides, as regards escapees and so on, and a very good and outspoken State Department man, and there was an American judge who was quite amusing, because he'd start off with everything to saying the whole government of Trieste is illegal. And then I was always told by Parsons to get some agreements out of him. He was quite a wise chap, and he'd eventually say, on the grounds it's all illegal, well, this is the advice I give you. And so I had to go to all these people. Another person I had to go to was the Marshall Plan had started now, and was the finance chap, head of the Marshall Plan. And I'd been put on to that as the British representative. Being a sapper, they thought I must know sufficient mathematics. I'll come back to that later, but we had these advisors, I think General Airy was the commandant, and he was brilliant. He'd been Alexander's chief of intelligence, and he'd organized the surrender of the Germans in Italy, and he was a brilliant brain. I don't know how they get hold of them in the army. And so I learnt an awful lot from these people. What I didn't know at the time, and I failed in, was that I was being tested to see whether to offer a job with the Foreign Office from there on, you see. And as it was, after 18 months there, the troubles in China had started and everything else, and I applied to go out to Hong Kong, and because, if you remember, the communists were beating up Chiang Kai-shek and Hong Kong was in danger. And so I went out there, much to the disappointment of a lot of people from the Foreign Office whom I'd getting to know and who'd taught me a hell of a lot.
How did you get to know that they were testing you out for the Foreign Office?
It was Parsons who told me later, and General Airy. General Airy came out, GOC Hong Kong, and he wrote to me and said, I was very disappointed not to find you here. By that time, I'd gone down to Malaya. because he's hoping that he was going to put me on his staff, and because he knew I'd speak Cantonese and things like that, and there's somebody he knew. So I made possibly some false steps. I was very disorientated, is that the word, or due to 5 years of war, and I've been on active service for a very long time, and I didn't have many people to advise me. I possibly should have married at this time, would have been better, and have had a bit more of an anchor.
So you were on the Boundary Commission 48, 49, were you?
47. No, that was 48, 49, yes. The Boundary Commission didn't take up all my time, because I had all these other things. Another thing I had to do was on the Marshall Plan. Now, the Marshall Plan, in effect, it wasn't all gift from the Americans. And this should be understood completely. They offered certain amount of money because Trieste was treated as a country. So one knows it. We remember we had the equivalent of 18 million lira. Or was it $18 million? $18 million, possibly. Lent to us by America. Now, we had to form what's known as the lira counterpart, an equivalent sum of money in the local denomination. This is exactly the same what had occurred to Germany and France and all their other places to whom Italy and so on they lent money to. So that all the money the Americans lent, the local country had to raise a similar amount, on both of which interest of 5% had to be paid to America. So the result was they got 10% on their loan, which isn't bad by any standard. So they got their 10%. But not only that, they said that all supplies from Marshall Aid should be bought in America, unless America couldn't provide it. So they safeguarded all their munition factories and so on like that, which were changing over, and they completely wrecked Britain's attempt to take all this trade. We were one of the few countries which hadn't been overrun, or this, that, and the other, and we might have made a very great deal of money out of this in Europe, but for this Marshall aid from America. Of course, we needed the aid as well. But this was a very clever method. Now, next thing, Marshall aid, they said that all supplies bought from Marshall aid should be transported in American bottoms, in American ships, unless, again, American ships weren't available. Well, this saved the American Marine, but it also ruined the British mercantile marine, which was taking charge then. And so Churchill said this is the most magnificent gesture that ever happened, but I don't think he realized that there was a lot in it for the Americans, a tremendous lot in it, immediate results in it for the Americans. And I could see this in Trieste, because we were a small enough place, you could see either side of it. And I knew this American treasury man very well, and he was a very clever chap. But he could talk and explain and do things like that. And I had to make out these planning papers and staff studies. Now, I used a method probably much the same as Wingate's method. I think it's the same as, I think I said, Socratic method of finding out the truth, what I call truth by insult. If I didn't know the answers, I would write out a draft planning paper in which I would say some outlandish things in order to give rise to a reply. And these papers were circulated to the British and American things, and Italians if necessary, and they would come back and say, this is totally wrong, this is what is right. And so I would get the answers that I want. But very often by seeing these people, they wouldn't give me the answers. But once I started to send out a draft paper, which was going to go to the United Nations, going to go to Washington and London and so on, again to Rome, they wanted to get it right. So I used to obtain the truth by insult. You understand?
By provocation.
By provocation. Well, this is what Wingate had done when he was forming his forces, and I think it did, of course, annoy a lot of people. So that when I was doing my planning papers, you know, I remember getting up to the sort of 38th draft before it was finally agreed, and it taught me a hell of a lot. And I also wrote a book, my first book, Prisoners of Hope, whilst I was there, and I think it's been welcome for its style and this sort of thing. And I think that I learnt a hell of a lot from Parsons and from Sullivan, who was very good at his English, and others, just by learning how to write staff studies and planning papers. In fact, throughout my rest of my career, I was my checkered career, I was used again and again by Greater London Council, by Shell, by Courtauld, whom I worked for in different parts of the world, to write papers, planning papers and staff studies, and to do investigations on efficiency and this, that and the other. And I was used to go, for instance, with Courtauld in Newcastle in New South Wales. I was told to look at the efficiency of it, and I went in right from the very beginning where the raw material came through, and when the finished material came out, and to find out what was wrong, what things were. I found out there was a limiting factor, a bottleneck, which was matching the colours of the output. And this formed a bottleneck, because only girls from Cheshire could do this matching very quickly like this. They'd been brought up to it for generations, matching of colours. And so they had to get girls out from Cheshire to do this matching, and this was the bottleneck of the production of this whole factory. It's the same building a huge dam for Sydney. They put me on to looking at production. There again, I found there were certain bottlenecks, which were there. And I think it's partly my engineering background or Cambridge, and partly this business of looking at a thing from the bottom to the end. But anyway, I was posted off to Hong Kong almost in a hurry because of the situation there, and I was